Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Scaffold is supported by the Architecture Foundation, bringing new voices to the conversation about architecture in London and around the world. For more information and upcoming events, visit architecturefoundation.org.uk. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and you're listening to Scaffold. In this episode, I speak with Lara Lesmes and Frederick Helberg of the experimental design practice Space Popular. Lara and Frederick met at the Architectural Association in London. Lara's originally from Spain and Frederick's from Sweden, and they established their practice after graduating in 2013. They made their name in exploring the architectural potential of digital space, and although their work is inherently speculative, our accelerating immersion in the virtual realm is a testament to Space Popular's prescience. I reached Lara and Frederick over Zoom in January 2022. I was in London, and they were in Los Angeles, where they were teaching at UCLA. In a recent exhibition at the RIBA called Freestyle, Lara and Frederick made the case that architecture has always been inextricably linked to mass media. And in our conversation, we explore their idea that virtual architecture is itself an altogether new form of media, with the potential to be produced and experienced at the very speed at which it's imagined. We also explore the darker, more dystopian aspects of our increasingly virtual lives, from addiction to surveillance capitalism, and in this light, talked about the responsibility carried by designers of the virtual world. And now, here's the interview. I hope you enjoy it. And just looking back at your early work and your early projects, there's a remarkable consistency and commitment to these ideas or to this relationship between the evolution of media and the evolution of architectural style in a way that feels so prescient, especially now. And I feel like only relatively recently has this concern become a mainstream preoccupation. And especially with, I mean, the current kind of events around, for example, Facebook's rebranding to Meta and the popularization of the term metaverse, which for a long time was purely a kind of science fictional fantasy. At least it was understood that way by the vast majority of people. And then also Microsoft buying Activision Blizzard for $70 billion. And all of a sudden this wider awakening to the significance of not only video games and the virtual spaces and communities that have developed around gaming, but also the relationship between game space and the metaverse as well. And so there's something incredibly topical, I think, all of a sudden about your fixation as a practice with the virtual and its consequence on architectural design. But at the same time, I feel like it's so important to, for me, understand where that preoccupation first emerged for you. Because, like I said, in 2013, this is not something that was front of mind for most designers. So can you bring me back to, I guess, the moment that you formed and the way that you developed this this personal agenda?
Yeah, I think it probably partially actually comes from, I mean, interest that we both had really from even before we started studying at architecture school, but also a little bit, I guess, in the sort of aftermath of the 90s French philosophy wave, let's say, in architecture, that when we started, when we were both studying at the Architectural Association in London, we both graduated in 2011, there was still some conversations around this sort of Deleuzean idea of the virtual and, you know, the whole psychoanalysis kind of discussions, etc. Of course, we were just, you know, treading along as naive students at the time, but started to really think about not virtual space as something digital or something computational, but a more broader idea of the virtual as just more as a conceptual idea, not as a mechanical thing, which is now it's really what it's thought about. And we're both really interested in the sort of power of virtual surfaces, like something like a fresco or something like a tapestry or even paintings, to contain information and stories that can have as much of an effect or even more on someone who's in a building than the building itself. So also that, and then starting to really do work before we started working with the technology itself, really on this sort of power of virtual surfaces and virtual content. And really then when we started to think about stuff that led to the project Freestyle, always trying to think sort of beyond the moment that we're in, because certainly some of the things that you just mentioned, they're really significant now, but there were way more significant things that happened 20 years ago informing this world that's now unfolding. And really, if anything, Freestyle, that project really taught us, and something that confirming our kind of ideas before that even, that you really need to look at a much broader historical context in order to understand sort of where we are now, what we're doing, and maybe where we're going. And then very directly, we did projects as students, imagining sort of buildings being psychological machine that changes when you turn around and when you turn back. I did a project called the Althing Hotel when I was in third year, which was like a big machine that physically performed like a VR space. I wasn't even thinking about this stuff then, but it's kind of the same project. It's just done in a different way. And then we started right even before we formed a practice thinking about what it means to be together on the internet, of course in video games and other things like this. And our first project really was in 2013, even actually before we formally formed a practice called the Cloud Resilience, which imagined a global mortality rate database, which also served as a platform to hold virtual funerals. And we designed our first avatars, and of course, speculative in our mind back then. and a project that really kind of informs a lot of the way we're thinking, because it was both a database that you could experience and you could actually then be face to face, so to speak, with others.
Little did we know when we did that, but I mean, now we're doing so much of that kind of work, and also research with students of thinking about kind of virtual archives as this kind of complex diagrams that then you can access at, let's say, many different scales. But yeah, I think then also to say that there is no particular moment when you kind of make a decision and like, I'm going to work on this kind of thing. And I must say that like the beginning, or like our work as students, especially I guess like also speaking for myself, my work as a student and then starting the practice was really like let's do stuff, and when there is enough of it you can look back and read it, because very often people ask like, oh, when do you decide to do that, and things seems to come together, and there is no moment in which you make a conscious decision, I mean ever, it seems, not even now either, but then eventually you keep looking back at what you have done and try to start to see paths that maybe you have already opened up and you could perhaps follow.
Well, let's continue looking back a little more at the early stages of the practice, which emerged in Bangkok, where you taught for a few years. I know you were based in Bangkok for 5 years before moving back to London. Could you tell me what you were teaching and I guess also the kind of projects you were working on in Bangkok at the time?
Yes, we moved to Bangkok right away. Like literally we graduated in end of June and we moved there the 1st of August, I remember. And we started teaching immediately. We moved for that teaching job. And we thought it wasn't going to work out in the beginning. A few months later, we realized like, yeah, this is actually this can be great. And we ended up staying for a very long time. We were teaching all kinds of studios from first. I was in the beginning teaching first and second year. You were teaching first and third year, right? And we were just writing so many briefs for projects constantly, which was a crucial moment because it forces you to think about methods and experiment them with groups of people at a pace that I had never experienced before. I keep trying to bring this back into the way we teach now, trying to create situations in which students have to do these sort of exercises where they are sort of teaching, because I felt like it was the most important part of my education happened at that moment. When you try to start creating good methods or good structures for people to find means to design and discover things within, but still have enough of a guideline to follow. So we taught all sorts of things. You always like to bring up that the first brief I wrote, this is hilarious. I mean, it's so systematic. I was trying to think like, well, usually you are allowed to do formally whatever you want, but you are given usually a brief that has a site and or a program possibly. And I thought like, well, what if all those things are open and instead form is the thing that is fixed and everyone had to build a sphere?
The only condition was that it had to be a sphere, but it could be anything, any size, any location, any program. It had to be spherical. Yeah.
And it was absolutely
But I think that so kind of is fun. Emblematic of that whole experience for us, because we also very quickly, at a very young age, became year coordinators, only 4 years at this undergraduate program. And we were year coordinators of second and third year, respectively, and then teaching up to three studios simultaneously that were only semester long, which meant that we wrote over like 40 briefs between the two of us. And that was like everything from like a lot of briefs about housing and a lot of briefs about spatial experience and about all sorts of different things.
But really weird things here and there. Parliaments, Frederick did a whole brief on flowers. That was incredibly beautiful as well. That's maybe one of my favorite ones. But the degree of experimenting, because also you were not expected to follow an agenda as maybe is expected in other schools, where like as you come in as a tutor and then you're expected to stick to the thing you're doing. And this was like, you could radically shift direction any minute. And that was absolutely fantastic.
I mean, it's actually very healthy for a school, I think. I think it evolved so quickly because we were also in our positions in charge with our colleagues for hiring and curriculum writing, which meant that this whole ethos of this kind of fast revolving change of topics and new faculty members constantly kind of meant that the school evolved extremely fast into something really quite phenomenal. And it's still one of the best schools of Southeast Asia. Not that we take credit for it at all, but so many people have passed through and it's really become an incredible place in the Chulalongkorn University.
Yeah. I mean, it's so clear that, as a student, you go through this really radical process of self-formation, you know, through producing work in a school of architecture. But we could say the same for architecture tutors as well. I think in the process of developing briefs or designing studios, there's a similar process of self-formation at play. And Laura, it's interesting hearing you describe that early brief of the sphere where all constraints are removed and anything is possible. Because it reminds me of, in a way, the mantra of your practice, which if we're looking at the logo of Space Popular, is all things, all places. And the sphere is the embodiment of this kind of infinite surface. And I'm really intrigued by that early attraction to the sense of the limitless, I guess, as it applies to choice, but also to aesthetics. And I think one other thing that I was drawn to early on, and this is going to sound superficial, but we're interested in surfaces in this conversation, so I think it's fair game. But the way that you both present yourselves to the world as designers, I find really intriguing. And it seems like even that sense of style or fashion for you early on had been decided. And I mean, for listeners who aren't familiar with the practice, if you Google Space Popular, you'll see Frederick and Laura usually bedecked in fluorescent garments, often synthetic and billowy. I mean, Frederick, you often have some kind of scarf, whether it's fabric or fur. And I mean, I'm only saying this because I don't see this as often anymore. The cultivation of a persona in architecture or design. And so, I mean, could you, just as an aside, tell me about your own style?
Yeah, I really have to attribute all of this to my mother. She, like, I feel like I was kind of born into it, because from very early on, I started to understand now that maybe she realized that in order to create a sense of confidence in me, she would always say that, like, you can be different and it doesn't matter, and that you can express through the way you look and it doesn't matter. So it is something, it's very funny. I went to a school where we wore uniforms, and she always made sure that I wear a slightly wrong uniform, and that was okay. And I remember at moments that was a bit, I was like, oh, this is embarrassing, or you just want to be like, honest. And then eventually you start to understand what that does to you, and the possibilities of the things that you can do with that, and eventually just becomes an inherent part of how you operate. I mean, I find back pictures of when I was whatever 7 years old, and the clothes don't look maybe too different from the way they look now, or like whatever, mixing different colors and have like color blocking and all of this was really a part of it, to the point that it has become something maybe quite natural that I wouldn't say we don't think about that much. It's just a kind of an everyday joy of like, and it's also a vehicle for almost workshopping around especially color palettes, color combinations and texture. So it is a very simple thing, I would say, in the end. It's not a there is no many complicated thoughts behind it. It just, why wouldn't you? You have to make a pick anyway. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, and this connections goes also both ways, because all of those scarves are from presents from Lara's mother without consulting me.
Oh, no kidding.
You should call her instead to ask about this, because she's the one that has the strategy. Yeah. I don't know.
But I think that generally also connects very much with sort of, because in my context, growing up in a very kind of average middle-class suburb of Stockholm, where this was not really a thing. I had a grandmother who was extremely extravagant in a really fun way. Where even when she couldn't walk anymore, she insisted on having her stilettos on in bed. And I also had the pleasure of growing up with one of my oldest friends, Nandi Nobel, who went on to study fashion design, is actually now one of the sort of leaders of thinking about virtual space based in London now. But he also, at a very early age in this sort of middle-class environment, similar, I guess, to what Lara's mother was sort of trying to influence Lara to think, is that these sort of things, they go beyond whatever immediate setting you might be in. And there's not so many, like, as Lara said, sort of kind of clever thoughts about this. It's just very simply, like, I remember us saying when we moved to London, it's just when you're in a city like London, if you wear what you want and you feel confident, then often you end up having even more interesting conversations with people. You know, the way that you interface with someone else is ideally deeper than what you see, but that's certainly a small part of it. And I think, at least in my life, I probably had a lot of really interesting discussions and exchanges with other people because of the way I choose to dress.
Mm-hmm.
I had very few discussions about football and other things that maybe I wouldn't be so interested in, and more discussions about other things, and perhaps also missing out on many interesting things.
It's interesting though, because it feels like the styles you've cultivated for yourselves also, in a way, function as an avatar for the work you do. And what I mean by that is, to me, your sensibility, your fashion sensibility, it maps so neatly onto the kind of work you design. I mean, a lot of your projects, be they virtual or real, are flamboyant and technicolor. And they feel there's something quite lavish about them. And there's an intense amount of variety and a layering of different styles from different eras into this very complex whole that I think suggests this idea of the complexity of identity, whether it's the identity of a project or of an individual. And I mean, further to that point, it also reminds me a lot of another designer who, in fact, was the first person I spoke with for this interview project for Scaffold. It was Adam Nathaniel Furman. And I wonder if you could speak to that relationship at all, if there's any kind of connection there for you.
Yeah. We share a lot of interests with Adam and listened to that podcast immediately when it came out. And we overlapped at the Architectural Association. I think we share a lot of interests with Adam, probably many things that we also don't share, but certainly this kind of, maybe without speaking for him, but speaking for ourselves, I think really at the core, it's an interest in communication and language. It's maybe sounds a bit abstract, but it connects with our discussion about freestyle and media, because we really enjoy seeing like the world as language, really the human world as language in one way or another, and that everything speaks even if it's not intended to. And of course, that's very divisive to say in the world of architecture. Many architects would strongly disagree, but of course, every single thing says something to the person that's observing it or perceiving it. And since we're interested really in practice that exists across different medias, and it's not only physical but also virtual, ideally, you know, the things that we create, they communicate and they speak in a kind of effective and kind of a clever way directly to, you know, what they're trying to serve, which then kind of, I guess, speaks towards this, maybe the way we sit, at least internally, the way we do a kind of fast change between different expressions of surfaces and of styles and of things. And then often, you know, the question about color often comes up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the words that you used, we definitely kind of agree, but we also a lot of times get called subversive and all sorts of things, you know, people that are sort of even offended by the way that we use these things. But since we're interested really in communicating through whatever we're doing and how spaces and objects communicate to people, then it seems like many of the things like color, variety of textures, which you also see in Adam's work, it seems like those are just more nuances and more words, let's say, or more letters, then we often come to the conclusion, why not use them? And why not use every single way you have in order to, especially if you think about a virtual space where literally everything is language. You know, there's nothing in there before you put something in there, which means that every single thing has intention, either functionally or, and of course, in a virtual space, function could just be that it speaks to you about what the environment is or what to expect, what's an affordance, what's not, etc. And then, yeah, we like to be precise, actually, with what we do, which is then often why there's a lot of contrast, a lot of color, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk more about what you mean when you say virtual space. So as an example, the exhibition at the RIBA, I think, opened just a few months before COVID became a global pandemic, and so had to close early, but then was reopened online as a virtual exhibition. And could you talk more about the platforms you used, and also what other is platform the right word, or venue or system would constitute virtual space for you?
Maybe stuck is the word, actually, no? What stuck you use, basically, like in terms of what code are you using? But yeah, platform is usually the... Mm. It's interesting because the platform that we use is like you then use the code to build your own platform, which is, in this case, we were using Mozilla Hub's stack. And the freestyle had to close weeks, actually, not even a month after it opened. And up until that moment, we were always really keen on whenever we used headsets in exhibitions, which was pretty much all of them, or all of them where we could afford to do so. Something that was very important to us is that to provide a good experience, and also what we will define then what we mean by virtual space, but to provide an access to these virtual spaces that was using immersive hardware, not so that you really, there was no frame, you could really feel like you were within it. At that moment, so up until then, the strategy was to basically, if you can bring a really good computer and a really good headset into the gallery where you are talking about ideas about how this type of media is going to influence architecture while you are also experiencing that media, then the message is conveyed through so many means, no? Through an argument that is usually unfolded through a narrative, but then also through the experience itself. And then, yeah, of course, then everyone is at home. No one can go into a gallery space. And we try to keep updated with the community of people who is developing immersive media. We started to see a lot happening in different what are called social VR platforms, which is really interesting because they are not games, or like there is no mission in the game or nothing to play. The game is to come together and meet other people. That is fascinating, no? Like that is what maybe every architect would hope public space would be, but maybe it's not, or like it's a physical public space that does that in a much more subtle way. And maybe I wouldn't feel very comfortable if random people comes and talk to me on the street. Mm-hmm. But in there, you literally go there and expect that people would come up to you and talk to you. And this was really interesting because it then transcended the hardware. We thought it was really dependent on it, all the experiences that we had created. And then we realized like, well, actually there is something happening in here where a space has to be created as context or as backdrop for whatever to happen within it. And what a complex and interesting architectural brief that is, no? And that goes back also to the way that we thought about briefs in the beginning of this, like when you start getting your first commissions and realize that briefs are not as specific as you thought, as the ones you got in school where you could really go about it by solving problems. And then suddenly, well, there is maybe less ingredients to solve and everything is actually quite open. And that multiplied by 100 when you're creating virtual space, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like, well, there is no problem or quote unquote problem to solve. And we began to see the power of these spaces in being social. And the fact that there are many things happening at the same time. You may go to see an exhibition, but then you're also in a sort of a space and there is other people. And that complexity of multiple things happening at the same time started to become interesting in the sense that maybe it started to speak for what architecture most often has to do. Many things at the same time that are partially defined, but not completely specific and might change across time. So we thought, of course, like, well, this is when you realize that the pandemic is going to be long, and can we, obviously we need to try and bring this online, and we had been using that that very platform during the development of the exhibition with Shumi Bose, with these workshops that we were doing as part of the RIBA's education program with high school students. And what we were testing out in those workshops is that we were using two platforms, right? We were using Mozilla Hubs as a means to build space with very simple, you don't need a massive computer, you can use a simple laptop and so on, which is what the students had access to. And we were using that together with Pinterest. So this was, and there could be a whole other conversation about Pinterest, which we think is one of the most interesting tools at the moment, that I know everyone rolls their eyes when it comes up, but there is something so inherently interesting about it. And with the students, it became very interesting because they did not have any architectural education. So we worked very intuitively, just providing them a means to exchange aesthetic ideas. You know? And then they would put together collections of references, and then we would go back and analyze them. Right, so like, okay, all of these things that you have put together, what do you think they speak for? And other people would come and also, I mean, we would do that as groups and see what is it that you're trying to convey, and with that, try to start opening doors to them on how you can then create, go about creating your own space now after you have gathered all those references and reflected upon what those references are speaking for. So, well, those spaces in Mozilla Hubs that the students created were also a part of the show. And then we considered that we could try and do that with the show itself.
I mean, maybe it's helpful to talk a little more about how the show is designed both physically and then virtually, where the organizing artifact or element is this giant rug that's unfurled across the entire expanse of the RIBA exhibition space. And on the rug is this striated graphic that indicates the evolution of style from the 1500s up until and beyond the present day, in fact. It runs diagonally, and it begins with something very comprehensible and familiar in terms of this kind of sequential evolution of a style. But then as we near the present day and move beyond it, these styles become increasingly distorted and complex and interwoven until in some way you've created a new tapestry or a new pattern altogether that to me was probably, it could be best described as a kind of noise, a kind of technicolor noise. And I think for me, because I think it should be said, like in full disclosure, I am also a photographer and was commissioned by you to document the exhibition. And I became totally enthralled in the carpet, which also in a way displays these different media devices from the printing press all the way to the VR headset. But I became enthralled with the kind of noise that you produced on the carpet as a way of visualizing this contemporary moment of virtual space that we're moving into, I guess, that we're already immersed in to some degree. And the incomprehensibility of that space, that it can only really be represented as noise at this point. And in that space of noise, I commend you for seeing a kind of utopian vision. But then when I was there documenting the show, I was also seeing people who were to some degree immersed in that space with their headsets on, encountering the exhibition through that mode. And being outside of that space myself, became aware of in a way, I'm not going to say dystopian at this point, but I guess another view of that reality, which is a view that we've become familiar with. And it's a view of the vulnerability of the digitally engaged. And so we associate this with, you know, people hunched over their phones and scrolling, or people kind of glued to their screens. And it conjures up to some degree ideas about addiction or ideas about the ways in which we're not only captivated by new media, but are captive as well within it. And I've got to say, though, that at the same time, we've always been captivated. And a person hunched over a book is in some ways no different than a person hunched over a mobile phone. But I think there is this other realm of virtual space that I wanted to explore with you that has to do with virtual space as a space of, in some ways, surveillance, of advertising, of intense capital investment. I wonder if you could talk more about maybe the darker side of the virtual and how, as designers, you want to engage with that or combat it or respond to it.
There's a lot to talk about here. I mean, in many ways, of course, like the virtual spaces that we speak about now, these like mechanical worlds, not the sort of dreamy worlds you can see in a fresco or in a tapestry, they are already, but also has the capacity to become the most politically kind of charged surveillance spaces that humans have ever built. And actually, in order for them to work, they need to be surveillance machines. There's a paradox here where like the kind of things that people want to build, there's no way of building them without tracking a person's eye down to, you know, a nanosecond. And we spend a lot of time thinking about this and just connecting with Lara, which is talking about, this is one of the things we do. We choose to work with the Mozilla Hub Stack because it's the only space available, which is based on built by a nonprofit that has a pledge for a healthy internet manifesto at its core that does not have any functionality to grab any data, collecting it, any data.
And it's open source.
And we think that obviously like anything in a capitalist system, you vote with your market choice. So we, even if it's certainly not the most sort of highest fidelity or even potentially the most interesting, we stick to it for these reasons. And there is something different happening now, because obviously the freestyle research showed us that addiction, that mm-hmm. has been around forever when it comes to media, and the lengths that people went to, like Christopher Wren, to get the books he needed to do like yet another church, was like pay an absurd amount of money for like literally a whole team to go around Europe to scavenge new books and etc. And that goes for, you know, to varying degrees for all different kinds of media. So the way that Queen Victoria was apparently obsessed by the stereoscope, you know, the first sort of VR device. But there are many things that are different now. As we say, you know, we are for the first time stepping into media where media is surrounding us completely. And of course, our physical body is still somewhere in the world. But you know, a media where we have a presence in a way that we haven't had before. And it's possible that we reach some sort of culmination. But this has also been said about previous media. You know, the amount of books and arguments written about how dangerous television was and how mm-hmm. it's going to destroy the world. And that has been said about everything from postcards to... so we could, of course, be sort of overreacting. But it's possible that when we step into media, as we're doing now, the sort of possibilities will be overshadowed over the shock to society. For us, it's inevitable that we step into media. And mm-hmm. as we say at the kind of cornerstone of many of the sort of work we're doing, is that we believe that by the middle of the 21st century, all media will be spatial, which would mean no more screens of any kind. No more laptops, no more smartphones, probably no more billboards on buildings, etc. Which will probably mean a lot of amazing advantages and possibilities when whatever we need media for, like communicate with other people or get information, whatever that happens to be, when that can be around you and in a way that we can actually also share it potentially. There's a lot of really interesting and possibly amazing possibilities in the next 30 to 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, there's also a possibility that this will serve as such a shock to the world, you know, to kind of, we often find a lot of inspiration in the now very old writing by Marshall McLuhan, the Canadian philosopher, about the fact that we can't fill a new medium with new things. We can only fill it with the old things. And in this case, the shock might be so strong that we might see either governments or other organizations kind of kick back at some of both the addiction that might be created when, as we're already seeing, not just people's lives, but entire career is already happening completely in this new spatial medium.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from dancers to performers to all sorts of people. And when that's starting to happen, the shock to the rest of society might be so strong that we might start to see either bans or restrictions. And this is where it comes in, the sort of our most recent propositions, or I guess you could call it a manifesto. That's always tricky, but I think people understand it best, that tries to somehow create some kind of contextual understanding of things that we think we need to do right now in order for this not to become something so shocking that we have to shut it down, which is, of course, a possibility.
I'm glad you brought up McLuhan, whose probably most famous declaration is that the medium is the message. And so despite the fact we can only fill new mediums with old, what is it? What was the line?
Well, we can only fill new medium with old things.
But with new mediums come new languages or new forms of expression or new vocabularies in a way. And so this kind of brings us to this question of value, which you've often asked in the work you do. Specifically, how do we assign value to architecture in a space where previous systems of value no longer apply? So in this case, scale, location, materiality, all of these things no longer hold any currency in virtual space. And so the cynical answer to that question is virtual space becomes a kind of repository for digital assets. It's a place where if you've sunk a lot of crypto on a new NFT, you can house it in the metaverse. But you're interested in other forms of value that emerge from new media and virtual media in particular. And I think the value you're looking for is in the new language that comes along with new media. And I wondered if you could speak more to these more optimistic kinds of value and their potentials in terms of the future of architecture.
Yeah, the question of value is a very complex one. We often talk about it from the point of view of heuristics, which is basically the way you assign value to something based on your experience of how much effort would have gone into making that thing, right? I think that this definition, like maybe you might have noticed, or like many of the ways in which we think, is this like trying to tap into the subjective or into these realms that are very hard to, you cannot measure them, and they rely very much on experience. And actually the writer Sarah Williams Goldhagen has this beautiful description or like the of experience that you sort of need to base it on some form of subjective universality, on like more something we cannot measure, but that we more or less all agree on it, which is also the way I feel about things that, like, for example, Pinterest is doing. It's like we have a common understanding of this, even if we cannot put words on it. So that is what's really interesting when you take value outside of numbers, which I think it always is outside of numbers. I think movies like The Laundromat, the Soderbergh's movie, or The Big Short, really bring you into understanding the nonsense, or like not accepting the subjectivity with which things that we think are numbers based and very measurable are actually relying on things that are very much floating and so on. So it all comes, even notions of value that we feel are so objective and measurable, like monetary value, are actually not so different from these more malleable ideas of value that maybe we concern ourselves with. And with regards to, like, for example, the exhibition Value in the Virtual, curated by James Taylor Forster at ArcDes in Stockholm, we were trying to just ask those questions and put them in a setting where they could be brought to a forefront. And it highlights one aspect of virtual worlds that where that becomes really clear. That is the fact that as you step into a virtual world, and related to the McLuhan quote that Frederick was bringing up, you are...
It's not a direct quote, she just mentioned. That's basically the gist of it. But
we step into, let's say, a quote-unquote new medium, and we do the things we know. No? We do the things we can speak, and therefore we fill it up with references, because otherwise it would be meaningless. And those references come with assignations of value. Mm. So at the moment we see gold, or we see whatever, something that looks very complex with a lot of polygons and whatever, and we see intricacy, you know, in maybe that geometry, and we see scarcity in the material that is being resembled. And even if we may know, like, well, actually that is not computationally very expensive, or the process to do that computationally was not so hard, but I get that you are trying to communicate value. Now, how long we will want to speak with that, let's say, again, quote unquote, old language, I don't know. Maybe then we start speaking a new language that derives from that medium, but we will only be able to come up with that language by inhabiting this medium.
Yeah.
Right. So this idea that you, like, step into a new format and you do something radically different is like, how is anyone expected to even be able to conceive of that? Mm-hmm. Whose mind? I mean, that's like a godlike mind that can actually conceive of something new.
And part of the possible sort of hopeful visions of the future of architecture, with specifically this lens of looking at virtual space, comes together with something that in most people's view is seen as something negative, because architecture is one of those things that historically has really communicated ideas of shared value, or you know, the buildings that are built then kind of functions as a way of a kind of cross-generational way of communicating values. That's at least it's been in the past. And if we imagine that the way that people experience space and architecture can be totally individual and changed by the second, it by necessity departs from that idea that everyone sees the same buildings, which means that buildings can communicate value across generations. And to some degree, the architecture profession is still, I think, operating in that way. And that's in some ways a really positive quality, but it might also be really positive if we kind of slowly start to deal with this idea that architecture, or things on architecture, or architecture as a container, can be a communication medium, and not just the way that, you know, a certain ornament communicates something. No. Literally, if that ornament is actually speaking to you, you know, like in the language you understand. And we often have this kind of abstract quote we think, or not quote, but idea, that will probably happen in our lifetime, is that we will experience architecture at the speed of the spoken word. literally you being able to create space and experience space at the speed that you form words in your mind that you speak, you know, through your mouth. And that we think is maybe seems scary, but like we are going to inch towards that very, very slowly. And once we're there, we will have, we think, just an infinitely more productive way to communicate with each other. And we don't yet have any model for the, how that will be possible, because it's technically not possible yet. But I think we're heading towards that direction. And it will be, once we're there, really incredible.
I feel like I could end it there, but I might end it there, but I do want to keep going for a bit if you have time.
Of course. Yeah.
I had so much trouble preparing for this interview, actually, because I felt totally overwhelmed. I think it's maybe because the work is so directly engaged with the moment we find ourselves in now, in a way that I feel like a lot of architecture isn't, out of necessity because of the scale and time it takes to produce it. And because we're so immersed in the present when we look at your work, I guess it just feels very close. I feel like I still need to be comforted. Like what the spiel you gave me, I don't feel satisfied yet, or I still feel incredibly wary of where technology is taking us. And I cannot believe I'm saying this out loud, because it's such a sign of maybe the age I am now, or the time in life I'm in now, where I've kind of moved to the other side and I'm becoming slightly technophobic or illiterate to new or emerging technologies. Or also a Luddite, frankly. And I think even 5 years ago, I wouldn't have been. But things develop so quickly. It just all of a sudden becomes, I think, a brave new world that I'm not prepared to contend with yet. And I think a lot of architects would agree with that and maybe not admit it openly, but instead defend the haptic value of real architecture, physical architecture, in a mindset that you've referred to as a haptic revival. And I think it's such a fantastic way of putting it, and it's not to put it down or belittle it. And I think it's a defense that architects often rely on to uphold the continued legitimacy or ever-increasing importance of real architecture in the face of a world that is increasingly digitized or digital or virtually experienced. And so I think I'd kind of put myself in that camp to begin with, that I'm kind of clinging to the importance of the physical in a way that I guess in some senses is conservative, but is also frankly ignorant of the kind of virtual environments that we're moving into. And so the other part, I guess, that I think I need I need you to help me with is the numerification of experience.
Yeah.
We talked about surveillance, and we talked about measurement, and to some degree your resistance to it in terms of the platforms you've chosen to use. So Mozilla in particular, which doesn't collect apparently a lot of data about the users who engage with the platform. It's not tracking your retina or your heart rate or your blood sugar levels or whatever. But in fact, all of these metrics do exist now and are available. I mean, everything from our fingerprints to our facial profiles and all our biometric data is kind of out there now and available for good or for bad. And I think that for me, there's still this hesitancy or wariness about where we're going in that regard, and also, therefore, what to do about it. And I think that you started to answer that question, but I wondered if you could you console me further?
Yes.
Or do you see the kind of work you're doing as in some way, do you have a kind of responsibility to address those concerns in a more upfront way? Because I think the kind of spaces that your work exists in now are the conceptual spaces of the gallery or the classroom, whether it's virtual or physical, or in conversations like these, which are more about the hypothetical. But the subject is so real and it is so pressing now. And I just wonder, because your work is so directly engaged with it, what you see your responsibility being.
Yeah. Well, in the spirit of the haptic revival, I would just give you a hug if we were not in Zoom. Which is the best form of comforting. And maybe that also speaks for the... that the only way to do, or for us to deal with these things, is to like spend time with other people that is doing these things, and to start noticing what kind of life takes place in these sort of spaces. And I don't know, it's like when you live in a city and you see people around you and you start having an understanding of the city and architecture by just being amongst those people and looking at them. And then if you look at them long enough without being a weirdo, then you start seeing something happening there, no? Like something begins to emerge. And I wanted to bring it to this realm so that, I mean, we could talk about the very particular issues and tracking and so on, but I wanted to bring in more two things we have experienced in virtual environments that have been so informative to and moving in terms of what is that life. No, I think we almost need to take it out of the like nitty gritty little bits that are very important, but that's it feels like that's just the details. And if you take it to like what is people choosing to do here, what are lives in here? What are human exchanges in here? Then you maybe begin to see something else. And spending time in some of these social VR platforms, we have experienced moments with groups of people that have started to point towards things that have started to point towards how these worlds are maybe fulfilling needs that that people has that they are not finding room for in maybe in the places where they physically live. I don't know, like spaces where people choose to go and fall asleep together in virtual reality. I mean, that just like blew my mind completely, and then started to make me understand what are the comforts that could provide. Mm-hmm. You know, that not having a physical body in there and then being able to comfortably fall asleep amongst people. I mean, obviously, eventually you take off the headset and you went to sleep. But this, looking at things like the way people use social media, I think it's a direct. You can link it directly to the individualization of life and even the invention of the corridor and the individual room of your own, right? And then from that room where you have your privacy, you are on your own, then you decide that you actually need to constantly reach out for others. So perhaps it's by looking at the things that we choose to do, and I mean we, you know, at large, we can start to maybe comprehend why we do them. And then, of course, come commercial interests and all these things to very quickly suck from it. But I feel like those are just like the little fish around the big thing that is happening, and that maybe thinking about what is it that is happening, what kind of life do we seem to be moving towards? And still, I would say choosing, and maybe that is the optimism in me. Maybe a lot of people think they are not making this decision, but I think it is a sort of collective decision that we are making. So in understanding this kind of life we are choosing, we can maybe see the humanity in it. Maybe I completely went, like, dodged your question, but I think another
perspective here is also that we actually think that we need more skepticism than what there is now. And this has to do probably with the fact that the step is so big at the moment. You read now, everyone is reading about this, with the recent Facebook rebranding, etc.
Apparently now, I mean, it took for Facebook to basically claim the whole thing for everyone to wake up.
But we think that we should all be voicing our concerns about this, because, as we said earlier, this shift in media might be so shocking that it literally breaks part of human societies, or create such incredible rifts between generations. You know, many of the same things that have historically critiqued other medium possibly doing, this is even more potential to do that. And of course, to give power to, in this case, companies, power that they really shouldn't have. So I think we would want to leave anyone who's listening to this or the kind of work that we do and audiences that we might have with an encouragement to pay attention and to not sort of buy into things you might just hear, we would rather see this happening very, very slowly and well and in a healthy way, rather than it happening even within our lifetime. Certainly, we're in a trajectory that, learning from the research with Freestyle, the first AR headsets were built in the 50s, and these dreams have been around for a very, very long time, and it's been happening slowly, and we hope that it continues happening slowly. I know that a lot of people are going to be very disappointed when you realize that this thing people call the metaverse, we're not going to get there in maybe 10 or 20 years. So all of these kind of shock value loaded articles that are coming out, they're also not on point with really what's happening. And hopefully a good and healthy critique starts to build up amongst the kind of larger population. This also ties in with our next project, this the big research project about portals in fiction, as a means to kind of looking at things that are popularized that will serve as important mechanisms in this future spaces. And for us, big thing that we're realizing is that many of these things that we might look at to inform fantasies or imagination of what these virtual spaces might be like, they're based on quite questionable and sometimes horrendous narratives. So it's not just what we do in virtual spaces now, but what we bring into them from previous media history, of everything from capitalism, colonialism, slavery in some case, elitism, etc., etc. Things that they're not a nature to this new medium. They actually come from stories told in previous mediums.
Maybe a good way of going about it is to try to withhold judgment and observe more, and then you see the different parts of these things that are happening. And I think we're at a time where we also seem to be very hard on ourselves with the things that we maybe feel attracted to do and that we enjoy doing, and then we have already imprinted judgment on that, and then we get to feel really bad about it. And I just think that, like, maybe withholding that judgment allows you to observe and to see the reasons maybe for, or to see at least a trajectory for how one makes decisions in the way that you choose to, maybe in this case we're talking about make use of media or resort to media for certain things, right?
Lara and Frederick, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Matthew. This was so much fun.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scaffold. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and I produce the show. The theme music is composed and performed by Luke Blair.
Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @scaffold_podcast. If you like the show, spread the word and leave a rating on iTunes while you're at it. Thanks to Lara and Frederick. Thanks as always to Scandal Lynn. And thanks to you for listening. I'm off for the next couple weeks, but I'll be back in late February. See you then.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.